Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is 9/02/2002. This session is, What is Evil, and How Do We Participate in Its Creation? This will be presented by Michael Horn, M.D. You can find this in our tape library, or order it under the designation of HOM 2002-01. Let's listen in.
I ended up into two this time, so now we won't have to rush too much. So before we start, let's say a prayer, because we need a prayer. We're dealing with this terrible topic. Our gracious and loving God, be with us in these discussions. This very difficult topic that we've all been immersed in the last 12 months. Help us to be able to discover the workings of your grace in this awful and disturbing area of our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
My name's Michael Horn, and I live in Seattle now for the last 3 years. And I'm a psychiatrist, but I'm also a psychoanalyst, and if you come to some of the other sessions, you'll hear a bit more about what that is. It's an important distinction as regards to theology and religion. Because in psychoanalysis, it's an opportunity to bring God in, although if you're familiar with Freudian psychoanalysis, Freud was quite agnostic, actually atheist. So I'm not a Freudian, I'm a Jungian. And I also teach part-time at the University of Washington. My interest is in trying to bring together theology and philosophy and psychoanalysis to try to find a way of integrating these areas, particularly in the area of psychological treatment in psychoanalysis. If you come to the forum tonight, you'll hear a little bit more about how this is done, how we try to do it. This topic has been of interest to me for a long time, really before 9/11. Anyone who does any work in psychotherapy, and I was the medical director of a women's hospital for a period of time, and many of the women coming into that hospital were abused. So I've been aware of how terrible child abuse and abuse of women is in the past, but I really got a sort of a visceral taste of it at that point. So I've been trying to sort of understand it psychologically, and then in recent years theologically. So we're going to try and find some redemptive elements in evil. And, but to do that, we have to understand a little bit about what evil is. Just so you don't get too disturbed about this, to get you in the feeling of what evil in your face can be. This is one of the murals in Belfast in the Protestant area. And this is actually the side of a house. It's a two-story house. So you can imagine how enormous it is. It's as big as, or as tall as this wall here. And we were visiting Belfast 2 years ago, and I've got a whole set of slides to show you, because this is an experience of evil that's sort of, that's, I have to find the right word, it's sort of everywhere, it's sort of, it's not just in the actions, it's these things that are everywhere around the people, all day and all night. So we'll be showing those slides as the talk goes on. But first of all, I wanted to talk about what we might think of evil as being. And then when we can begin to understand other ways of conceptualizing and defining evil, I think we've got a much better chance of living with evil constructively, and that's possible. I think it is possible. Now, in ancient times, and even today, you'll hear of evil spoken of as though it's something. Sometimes it's looked on as a force in nature, a destructive force. So, like hurricanes or tidal waves or earthquakes, some people will look on those as manifestations of an evil force in nature. But then, more developed views of evil are still related to evil being something. And so evil's usually located in some type of personified force in nature. And we hear about the devil in our Christian theology. And devils of different forms have been part of pretty much every religion throughout history. And then the next step in this sort of what we call a real or concrete view of evil is that evil is located inside human beings. That human beings actually have a tendency or a propensity to evil. And this is the idea of original sin. So a lot of these ideas that evil is actually something in nature or in humans are still around. And of course a very difficult idea, because how can you deal with evil if it's something? It's always going to be there. It's always going to be rearing its ugly head in one form or another. So philosophers, once they got started, the Greek philosophers in particular, tried to find other ways of conceptualizing evil. And Plato is one of the most famous of the Greek philosophers. He had an idea that that evil was actually the absence of good, or the ignorance of good. And good was actually something that was sort of out there, that there was some way that good could be accessed and we could know about good. He wasn't explicit in defining it, but it was some presence out there. And Plato's idea of good, the good outside the world, which he called the form of the good, was the origin of St. Augustine's concept of God, that God was the all good that was present in the universe as the force of good, and that there was no evil, that evil was actually just the absence of. But Augustine was using Plato's philosophy to figure that one out. Now the other philosopher that comes into this is Aristotle. And Aristotle had an idea that good was more of a moral thing that could be understood. And good was the balance between perfection in one side of one way of doing things and the imperfection on another. It was somewhere in the middle. It was called the golden mean. So Aristotle began to start to get a sort of a philosophical or rational way of looking at good. And then we talked about Augustine, but then throughout the Middle Ages, all the different ideas of good and evil were there. Good as being evil as being the absence of good, the Christian Augustine view, but devils and witches and all sorts of ways of looking at evil were present. And it wasn't really until the period of the Enlightenment, which was the period where science was getting going and humans thought everything could be figured out rationally, that philosophers started to have another crack at figuring out what was good. And again, they tried to figure it out rationally, so you could define what was good, exactly what was good. And you'll see in a minute how this has all sorts of problems, because in this conflict here in Northern Ireland, each side thinks they've got a handle on the good. Of course, the other side is the side that doesn't have a handle on the good. Now, these ideas of being able to define good in some sort of a rational way persisted right up until the end of the 19th century, when a person called Friedrich Nietzsche, which you may have heard of him, his famous phrase is, God is dead. And what he was trying to get at was that all these moral ideas that all different religions had figured out were actually constructions by the religion, the people of the religion themselves. So there wasn't any real basis for defining what was good. Everybody said it was our God that passed it down in tablets or in revealed writings or something. But every religion had some sort of a claim for their version of the good. They were similar, but not always similar enough to prevent terrible wars that went on between the religious groups. And some of the origins of this conflict in Northern Ireland is a religious war. So Nietzsche was really saying that we have to go back and take a look at how we define good and, of course, evil. And the God is dead idea was really wasn't that God was actually gone or an absent presence. It was these ideas that God somehow could be found and could call him up or her up and tell you what was good. So in a sense, he began the sort of skeptical modern era where we think religious truths have been subverted or not valid any longer. But actually, in a way, he's revitalized religious truth, because we have to search in another way to try and see what is good and evil. And this is what we'll be trying to talk about during the week, struggle with, because it's difficult. Because we all want to have some way of saying, oh, this is the good, it's written in these tablets, this is the good, God revealed himself to somebody and said it. But what we're really going to have to struggle with is human ways of discovering good and evil. And then we'll begin to discover how God works within us to help us discriminate and figure this out. Now, in the what we call the postmodern era, which is the era we're living in, and it's really been around for about 50 years, and taking off from where Nietzsche just really destroyed everything in a certain sense, destroyed all the rational ways of thinking about, particularly morals. The postmodern era really says that all we're doing when we're trying to define what is good and evil is just trying to make an assertion. We're trying to decide. And of course, once we decide what is good, then we've always got to leave something out. And what gets left out, or what is not, can be defined as evil in various circumstances. Now, postmodernist philosophers will go even farther than this. Whenever we make an assertion about anything being true or existing, or just even if we make an assertion, some of the more radical postmodernist philosophers will say, we're always leaving something out because there's always something to be discovered. So what they're saying here is that the very act of deciding on anything leaves something out. And their whole view about trying to be present in a full way in any living situation, to try to take in as many perspectives as possible. Everyone okay so far? Yeah. This is tough. So you can begin to see there's a Christian part to this, or there's a spiritual part to this. And there's a whole group now of postmodern philosophers and theologians that are now trying to understand and work with this rather radical concept. And we'll be working with that in the second session tomorrow evening. We just want to get the basic definition now. So the most radical way of thinking about this, and this always upsets people when I do discussions, is anything that we assert always leaves something out. We can never, just using language is going to leave something out. Because language just takes a partial understanding of things, really. The words, of course, are just signifiers for a whole lot of other stuff that's going on. So even anything that you say is going to leave something out. So you're always leaving something out, no matter what you're doing. So this actually leads us over into a rather interesting way of looking at existence, that there's always something else that's going to be there for us to discover. We've never got it down. We're on our deathbed and we want. I was saying the other day, we need 5 more minutes, God, please. Yeah. Something else. So it actually leads us into a hopeful place, I think, rather than a dismal place. And I hope you'll be able to see how it leads us out of some of these dreadful conflicts that we see. So let's do the slides now. And then I'm going to do a little bit of a history of how this whole leaving out occurs. And you'll be able to see how almost every system of thinking leaves something out. Just before we do the slides, though, what happens when we leave something out? Is that something becomes something strange and alien and disturbing. And the group that decides to leave it out can often set up their own system of thinking about how life should be led. And the left out group becomes the evil group. The left out group can be shunned and denigrated or shamed or pushed out of the living situation, like ghettoized in some way. In the worst cases, they can be deported, like the early Australians were from England. A lot of the early Australians were convicts, or most of all of them were convicts. And the convicts in those days were usually the poor people and the Irish rebels. So whenever there was a rebellion in Ireland, the British would pack them all into ships and send them to Australia. First of all, they send them to America, and then the revolution occurred, and then they all went to Australia. So Australia was really started by the left-out people of Britain. And those left-out people had to be released into the country eventually, and those left-out people started businesses and became pastors and politicians and etc. Basically started the country. The pioneer of the wool industry in Australia, which is one of the biggest agricultural industries, was an ex-convict. But this whole thing of the leaving out got transformed quite dramatically. One of the results of the Australian experience was the whole idea that there was a criminal nature. This was a big thing in the 19th century, was debunked. Because these terrible criminals from the east end of London and these rebellious Irish people turned out to be the builders of a new country. At the worst case, of course, people can be attacked, obliterated and killed. And of course, this is what we see here in Northern Ireland, and this is what I think we saw in 9/11, with the terrible events that we saw there. So let's just go through the slides, because they're just a dramatic depiction of what I call evil in your face. And this is in Belfast, Northern Ireland. And the area where the troubles have occurred is just a very densely packed, very low-class area, very poor area, where the Catholics and Protestants were previously living together before the troubles really got going in 1968. So the two main areas that they live on, the Shankill Road and the Falls Road, are actually parallel to each other, running almost side by side. The Shankill Road is the Protestant area and the Falls Road is the Catholic area. And when you visit here, there's no tour buses that go down these roads. And you can't walk down there because who knows what side you're on. Now everybody knows everybody who's a Catholic and a Protestant. If you stray over into the Protestant area, you can be assaulted or even killed. And while we were there, the poor guy was moving his house, one of the Protestants. And he had to go. It was nighttime, about 10 o'clock at night, and he had to go and get something from another house. And it was dark, so he strayed into the Catholic area. He got caught by the Catholics and blamed. The Protestants were going to be blamed for breaking the truce, because the truce was going at that time. So the Catholics actually handed him back to the Protestants, and the Protestants shot him in the kneecaps. This shot his own person for breaking this truce. So that's the intensity of violence that goes on. And so we were, the only way to get down there is to take a taxi ride. And the taxi driver has to be an okay guy for both areas. And we were hoping he was telling us the truth when he said, "I'm okay." He took us down the Shankill Road and the Falls Road. And I took these pictures from the car. My family was pretty terrified that I was taking the pictures. Nothing happened.
What is the flag?
That's the Protestant flag. You see flags everywhere. I'll show you, I'll run you through this. This is on one of the Protestant houses. UFF is one of the Protestant paramilitary groups. Here we go. This is what you see. These are the housing areas, and the red, white, and blue is the signifier of the Protestant group. When we first saw this, as we were driving up from Dublin, the little towns on the way up, little Protestant towns, we thought there was some type of festival going on, because there were these pretty flags flying and the sidewalks painted like this. And it wasn't until we got to Belfast that we found out what this was. This is a keep out sign. This is a marking of our territory. This is a what is area. This is our area. This is the fine fly markers. It's quite frightening when you realize what it is.
So that previous slide was a Protestant,
right.
And so obviously was not a depiction of evil.
They're
not saying I am evil.
No, that's true.
So what would that have been a depiction of? Because we wouldn't look at it and say evil, but...
Right. Well, that's the terrifying. It's the violence. It's the destructiveness.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much the evil.
That we do to others.
Yeah. It was actually looking at it, because I felt that it was directed at me. Yeah. I felt the murals on either side were directed at me. Yeah. So I had a feeling that evil was coming at me.
Yeah.
But this is the violence that's contained in the image.
This is a Protestant looking at himself. That figure was a Protestant figure with a Protestant form.
That's right.
Killing somebody.
That's right. Threatening somebody.
And that was good.
Yeah, that was good. That was a good thing.
He looked like death.
That's right. Well, he's death. He was. He was the hand of death.
Death to the Catholics.
Okay. Yeah. And you see these two-story blocks of apartment blocks. And on almost all of them, there's one of these huge murals. You'll see this up close in a minute. These are some of the martyrs. You'll see, but some of them are the same sort of threatening violent murals that you were commenting. And here's what we saw when we were coming up the coast. You know, these nice little houses with British flags. See, the British flag is the signifier for the Protestants, because they're the loyalists to Britain. And here's the large areas in between the blocks of apartments.
Now, do the Catholics want to separate from Britain?
No, the Catholics want to. Oh yeah, the Catholic wants to separate from Britain. Yeah, the Catholic wants to separate. The Protestants don't.
So they want to take a chunk of Ireland and just consider it by themselves?
No, the Catholics want to make Northern Ireland part of Southern Ireland or Ireland itself.
What do they want to do with the Protestants?
Well, they want to keep them there, you know. They're not going to kick them out or anything like that. Kill them off. Or
build
who knows?
Property for the most part.
The Catholics do?
No, the Protestants.
Protestants are the wealthy class in Northern Ireland. Although here in this particular area, it's the poor Protestants and the poor Catholics. When you get out and meet the middle class Protestants, they don't want to have anything to do with this at all. They don't even want to talk about it. We went and had afternoon tea with someone who's a friend of my wife's on Vashon Island, a brother of a friend of my wife's on Vashon Island. And they didn't want to discuss this with us, the middle class Protestants. This is something that's going on amongst poor people inflamed by demagogues on either side.
For those that would like a pretty good understanding of the issues there, I just finished Leon Durst's book, Trinity. I never read it before. I've read all of his other books, but it does a wonderful, have you read Trinity yet?
No.
It does a wonderful job of discussing the Catholic-Protestant conflict and the intensity of the feelings of both sides. Totally amazing book, Trinity.
Okay. And this was a very horrifying sight. We were just parked right here on the road. You see those two little girls there? They're about 10. And they walked past the car, and one of them was carrying what looked like an automatic rifle. I thought it was actually a weapon. And I was wanting to get out and actually take a picture of it, but my family were pulling it was much more than a toy, and there were two little girls, and you know, little girls rarely play games with guns. It's usually little boys that do this, but it was absolutely realistic replica. I'm assuming it was a replica of an automatic weapon. And right next to them here is one of these martyrs. With those two men have rifles, they're shooting rifles across the matter, and they're just walking across this place. And the juxtaposition of these two children, little girls, one carrying a replica of a gun, and this dreadful mural was just really disturbing. And here's some more of the Protestant murals. And again, this is that like that skeleton. This is a threatening murals. Here's the prison depiction of the prison where the Protestants are imprisoned by the British, and they see themselves as victims of the British. They're political prisoners rather than criminals. It's a bit the same sort of thing that we're dealing with now with the Arab terrorists.
So they have separate prisons?
They do have separate prisons for them. Originally they just put them in criminal prisons, but there was hunger strikes and riots, and now they're in separate prisons. And here's what particularly the Protestants do to inflame the Catholics. They have marches through the Catholic areas, particularly on the day of the Battle of the Boyne. The Battle of the Boyne was in 1610, I think, something like that, 17th century, when James II was defeated by, I think it was Cromwell, William and Mary. The British, and just up a little north of Dublin. And this is how many years, 300 years ago, and this is still a terribly painful experience for the Catholics, and a way that the Protestants will lord it over the Catholics, because this is when they march on the day of the Battle of Boulogne. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is signifying. They're marching down from their church and they're off to march to the Catholic area. Here's another one for prison. Now here's what the Protestants think about Gerry Adams, that he's just really a tool of the British. Gerry Adams was a Sinn Féin member, and now he's renounced that and he's trying to be more political and lead the Irish political movement. And they think he's just a tool of the British. Now here's another one about the from the Protestant side. And before the Battle of Boulogne, the Protestants felt very persecuted in Northern Ireland, because Ireland was all one country at that stage. And they still think that persecution is occurring. Ethnic cleansing is still going on all those years later. Now this is one of the martyrs, and I thought, he looked like just a regular person. This isn't a terrifying one. He's the guy that leads a death squad, a Protestant, and was killed, and there he is. It's like somebody's dead. Now this is the wall that separates the two sides. It's like a Berlin Wall. Mm. Enormous. It's about 40 feet high. There's another picture of it. You can see how tall it is.
Who put the wall there? Was that the
I think the British government.
British government
did that. Now this is the Catholic side. And the Catholic side initially looks a little bit more benign. The Catholics look more like victims. This is Bobby Sands, one of the Catholic martyrs who died in a hunger strike about 15 years ago now, I think. And Bobby Sands is an absolute hero. He's like a saint on the Catholic side. This is the Catholic side. They don't live in these apartment blocks. They're more all pushed together in smaller areas, sort of congested areas of the Catholics. Now on the Catholic side, because they've got the long history of martyrs going back to early times fighting the British, and they put forward their women martyrs, and this looked a little bit more sympathetic for a while, but we'll see it doesn't quite follow that path. Here's some more of the women martyrs. And here's a really horrifying, I don't know who put this up, but I think this was someone that was trying to sort of look at both sides. It's on the Catholic side though. These are rubber bullets. And these are children and bystanders who were killed with rubber bullets at this particular area. This is an area up the top of the Falls Road where there's been a lot of rioting. Just recently there was a horrible riot there where Protestants were stoning young girls going to school. I think you might have seen that about 6 months ago. So this was a really awful thing to see. But here's what the Catholics think. History is written by the winner, so they're still fighting. They're not giving up. So this was a really sort of dramatic depiction of this way of defining evil, that what is, that's our side, is good, and what is not is evil on the other side. And then just the reverse. And the horrible part about this is that these are both Christian denominations. This is like the religious wars of following the Reformation. It's a terrible sight. Now we've just got we've got more time than I thought. Good. Because I wanted to get a bit more philosophical, sort of go back a little bit and try and take a look at the whole what is not, because it's not as though philosophers have just discovered this in postmodern times. It's actually been going on forever. is if we think back to the first cosmogonies, or ways of thinking about how the universe is constructed, pretty much all of them have either something emerges from nothing, or cosmos or order emerges from chaos, or light emerges from darkness. So if we look at those three, they're dichotomies. We're saying that order is better than chaos, or something is better than nothing, or light is better than darkness. Of course, in our Christian mystical tradition, we're actually interested in darkness. And we're interested in nothingness. And we're interested in chaos. You'll hear about tonight when we do the forum, because chaos is an important thing to get into if you're going to have any change in the what is. Because the what is an organized system of how things are. And until we can get into some chaos about that, no change or transformation or new knowledge or new perspectives can emerge. So chaos and order and nothingness and something and light and darkness are actually just two poles or two ways of looking at what's there. And yet almost every cosmogony will try to establish something that it can feel grounded or feel secure or feel organized. Later on tomorrow, when I talk about how to transform evil, we'll be looking at the concept of the shadow in Jungian psychology. And Jung actually called it the shadow for this very reason. It's the dark part of our personality that we don't want to look at or want to know about. And I'm going to be, when I'm talking about God in space, I'm going to be talking about the void, or the space where we can't get a footing or a foothold. And that's another place where something new can emerge. Something comes out of the void. And something comes out of a totally unknown and disturbing space. And I'm going to be trying to help you see that this something is God. So that God can actually be found in the darkness and in the chaos or the void. Now, as these cosmogonies went along and turned into what's called cosmologies, or way of understanding the world itself, the idea of purity developed. And we still hear about purity. Someone was saying the other day that purity is gone out of our ways of thinking. Not really, because almost every religion, Lutherans don't have food restrictions. I'm a new convert to Lutheranism in the last 3 or 4 years. But Catholics have the fish on Friday. They're not supposed to eat fish on Friday. When I was a kid, people were still doing that, probably still doing it now. And then the Hindus have a restriction against eating beef, and the Muslims against pigs, etc. So there's all sorts of purity rites or purity restrictions that are still inherent in religions. I think that Christian baptism in some ways can be looked on as a purity ritual, especially the immersion idea, that you're being immersed and sins are being washed away. We often use that metaphor of sin being washed away. So the idea of purity, I still think, is around. And it runs into the idea of defilement. That's another idea. We still hear that. We still sometimes hear sin and defilement sort of put together. And we still have things, rituals about washing hands. And Jesus washing the disciples' feet, that's actually a purity ritual. Now, of course, in Jesus' time, the Jewish code of prescriptions, or the law, as Jesus calls it, was full of rituals of purity of different sorts. So being pure is the next step, really, in trying to exclude other things. And I'm pure and undefiled, and that person is dirty. And these things can be transported over and become literal. Like, people can actually be called dirty, or people who are dirty. Homeless people, they're dirty people, and therefore we wouldn't want to have anything to do with them. Or even the color of people's skin, like white people. You can think of people of different colors as somehow being dirty. So this purity thing is around in our subconscious. We're still thinking that way in a certain primitive sense. Now, we've talked a little bit about how when we establish what's good and what's right, we cut something out and we exclude it. And the early ways of looking at sin were that sin was a transgression of God's edict. Every religion had a different way of looking at this. So there was various codes of sin. And then the Jewish religion, which our religion is a development of course, really got going with this whole concept of the law. And it wasn't just the things in the Ten Commandments. It was all those different things that the scribes and the Pharisees were doing in the New Testament. And so any way, once you start laying down what's right and wrong, it just sort of magnifies itself. Yeah.
I was reading this book, Voice of Summer, and Jackie Robinson went and negotiated with the hotel people.
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, okay, you can come as long as you don't go to the pool.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just hit me that was probably the dirty.
That's right. Exactly. And the dirty thing too was probably in the south when they used to have different water fountains too.
Absolutely.
So this defilement idea is still there. All these ideas of separating out what is from what is not under various criteria are still there. Underpinning all this. It actually gives it an emotional underpinning that's rather intense, like in the example we just gave you. So God's edicts become the way of saying what is and what is not. And God's edicts become, like we said, developed by the culture. They start off as things that Moses, the Ten Commandments, which are probably things that pretty much every human culture can agree upon, because it's about ways of relating to other people. But then it all gets magnified by priests and various experts, and the whole thing becomes a way of controlling people's lives, organizing people's lives. Now what the postmodernist philosophers have got into with taking a look at this is looking at just what I was talking about, how religious ideas about what's right and wrong, and then any other ideas about what's right and wrong, like a communist idea. Communism started off as a way to help poor people get a better deal. But then eventually it became a whole set of right and wrong and who's out and who's in and who should be made war against and who should be deported and who should be put in concentration camps, etc. And fascism is another tremendous right and wrong system that's got going in our time. So these big things are called what are called meta-narratives. They're great big stories about what's right and wrong, and they begin to govern the whole way that people organize themselves. And then, of course, the groups that are in the fascist organization or communist organization or the Christian organizations, as we see here, then start to attack the other groups. And then, in the worst cases, want to obliterate them and kill them. So we're doing okay at this point? The idea that humans define what's right, and everything else is what's wrong. You guys are accepting this pretty well. I usually get horrible questions.
We do that with death too, around purity. You know, a child says, "Oh, look, the bird's dead." You know, don't touch it; it's
That's
dirty.
Right, exactly.
You know, and it's not. Death is dirty.
Well, you're okay with this. I'm shocked. Well, let's do some examples. We just had one. Go ahead.
Oh, I just said we're enlightened. Enlightened.
Let's do some of the others. Oh, go ahead.
I was just wondering how the postmoderns don't seem to think there's any real foundation for making these decisions from the law. Which leads them to the charge of being nihilistic.
Exactly.
And I'm
realistic.
Not a fan of postmodern thinkers at all.
Right.
But going back to this idea of the exclusion and inclusion, this has been a fact throughout all of human history.
That's right. That's right.
And the philosophic question is, is there any real rational foundation for making this distinction between us and them?
Right.
And we all appeal to certain kinds of standards, and are some standards better and morally valid than others?
This is the opposite argument. I'm a little relieved. I was getting worried about this. Because these are the two opposite points, nihilism and relativism. If we go this direction, are we just going to be like Nietzsche and everything, nothing means anything, and everything's up? Well, that's not, Nietzsche is just nothing means anything at all. Actually, he resurrected things because he got the will to power. Yeah. So he couldn't stand being totally nihilistic. And then postmodernists are always accused of being relativist. Where one person's morals are as good as the other person's morals. And that's what we're going to struggle with tomorrow. But that's the question that I wanted you to bring up. Very important.
Nietzsche was the God is dead concept.
Right.
I was reading Viktor Frankl's book, and he had a quote from Nietzsche that he who has a right to live can endure almost anyhow.
Right.
And that to me implies that Nietzsche's belief that there was something
right
out there.
That's right. There we go.
That's the other thing I want to say. But there's always something. If God comes back, all these deconstructive or breakdown systems, God actually comes back somehow.
Yeah.
Because Nietzsche's, in a way, a very religious person. The will to power, it really isn't the will to power over other people. It's power over oneself, which is the interesting part of Nietzsche's system. But what the postmodernists are getting at here, which is something we have to answer somehow or other, and they're answering themselves, because I'm a postmodernist psychoanalyst, as you'll see, is that language itself gets us into trouble. Because language always leaves something out. And any assertion that we make always leaves something out. Coming back to that problem of language. But also, the psychological problem that the postmodernist philosophers haven't addressed, but contemporary sort of postmodern psychoanalysts will address, is that we're always searching for certainty. And certainty and assertion about what is goes together. That the essential human problem is actually the problem of searching for certainty. And I'll be talking more about this when we talk about space. But one of the things that we always think of, we've got to get our feet on the ground. We've got to find our place. We can't fall through the cracks. We can't go over the cliff. Of course, we can't fall into the void. We can't float off into the clouds. We've always got to feel ourselves secure and certain. Now, certainty gets linked up with these assertions that we make. So at the core of our psychological nature, of the fact that we are strange creatures that arrive, got thrown into the world, and then we're going to disappear. As Christians, we hope that there's some afterlife, but we don't know for sure. Jesus is the only one that came back, so we don't know. So tied up and get away from this whole relativism thing, to get into the struggle with uncertainty, will get us into the spiritual side. Because what Nietzsche couldn't stand being nihilistic. He had to come back with the will to power. And something spiritual, some force, something beyond the human situation. So it's important to be able to do the deconstructive side. That's the side of looking at language and saying, well, you just figure this out, and here it is, and da-da-da-da-da, and here's all your premises. And it's not really based on anything that goes back to something that we can actually completely depend upon. That's good to be able to do that, but that does leave you in the nihilistic and relativistic position. But if you look at this, that language is just linked with the struggle to be certain, then you can go into the struggle with uncertainty. And then in the uncertainty is where God is present. This is what I'm going to be trying to help you see with more examples as we go along.
Does the importance of ritual play a part in the concept of the importance of certainty?
Well, it can't. See, ritual is a two-edged sword. It's a little bit like deconstruction. Deconstruction can lead you into nihilism and relativism, but it can also lead you into an openness, an open place in language where something new can arrive. So ritual can be used as purely as a certainty. You know, if we wash our hands, or if we put water on our forehead or whatever, if we burn so many candles or do whatever, that can make us feel secure that God is present. But we can also use ritual like the labyrinth, like walking the labyrinth. Because walking the labyrinth is walking into a void-like space, if we really get into what the labyrinth is trying to talk about. The labyrinth is a very ancient way of what I call opening space in space, finding a space where we're in an uncertain place. So if we can use a ritual like walking the labyrinth, or other rituals, of course, the Eucharist is always a tremendously opening type of a ritual. You know, eating Christ's body and blood, if we really take that in every time we do it, we can do it as a certainty type ritual, but we can also do that one as an uncertainty type ritual. And baptism can be the same way, because baptism is a way of passing from one place to the other. The ancient baptism is actually done on Easter Saturday night. And actually, Easter Saturday is the best day of all for the whole. Because that's the day when God is God. And nobody knows if God's going to, or Jesus is God. Nobody knows if Jesus is going to be resurrected. You know, we think, oh, Easter Sunday is coming. But if you really go into it, he's died. And like the disciples, we don't know if he's coming back. And so Jesus gone is a wonderful ritual of uncertainty. Like, I think Easter's the best Christian ritual of all. Because one of the things that we do in the Christian religion, that Jesus actually died, is a marvelous opening to uncertainty. It's like what you're talking about is death. Death is the tremendous what is not. We shun death. And baptism was actually done on Easter Saturday. We did a service in Palo Alto when I was there, an Easter Saturday service, and we had baptism. So it's like the people waiting for baptism were put in a special place, and certain sort of place. It was like an initiation. And then they'd actually walk through the baptismal font. They'd walk underwater. And they'd come up on the other side with the dawn coming. So again, it was going through a very uncertain place to arrive at a new certainty. So again, ritual can be a two-edged sword.
Well, so many people talk about ritual and they really mean ritualized behavior.
That's right, exactly.
You know, where exactly. I'm in control, I know exactly what.
Exactly.
Exactly. Rather than the mystery of ritual.
That's right. Ritual has to be a mystery. That's why the labyrinth is so great, because you can never, it's hard to make a labyrinth into something you can control. It's just set up the way that it isn't. Yeah.
How is all of this, you know, words connected with actually incorporating this into your life? I mean, we can sit here and talk about this, the postmodernism, you know, this and this and this. But nothing really matters until our behavior matches
right.
What we're actually talking about. It matches the ritual, or it matches whatever. Behavior somehow has to come in there.
I'd like to add one other little thing to that.
Yeah.
I think you and most of us presuppose that evil is always done by a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And that all of this talk about what the Protestants and the Catholics are doing presupposes that some of them are being evil and some of them are being good. Or at least we know what evil is. We know what evil behavior is.
That's right.
And Freud said there's no such thing as evil behavior.
Right.
And that's why we're all adrift in this postmodern fog.
Again. What we're going to define evil as, and I've been sort of hinting at this, and I don't want to actually answer your question today if I can avoid it. I want to keep you in a state of uncertainty. It does take a little while for this to sink in. It's sort of scary and frightening. When you first read Nietzsche, if anyone of you done this at college or after, it is quite a disturbing theory. And postmodernism is quite disturbing when you first really take it in, that everything can be deconstructed. It's like there's an infinite regress that you can keep going back, that nothing can actually be taken back to some origin. You see? So it's a very uncertain place to be in, either a Nietzschean way of looking at morals, that there's no grounding for morals, or a purely postmodernist way of looking at anything that's stated can always be broken down in some way. So it's like a meditation. I was hoping, usually when I do this, I do the redemptive side of it in the same lecture. I wasn't going to do that. So you could dream about it. Okay. But I'm going to be working on that tomorrow, because there's a wonderful redemptive side to it. Just like in Easter, there's the resurrection after Easter Saturday.
I had two comments. First was on when you're talking about Holy Saturday or the Easter Vigil. In the Catholic Church, it's very significant that they take the Eucharist out of the church. Mm. And it's the one day there is no Eucharist in the church. It's put, usually it's in the sacristy, but it's not in the church is to be like a tomb. Mm-hmm. And so when you come to the Easter Vigil service, which is at night, mm-hmm. you know, it you've got that feeling. It's taken out actually Good Friday, and that's it.
Right.
When you were asking what is evil, at the very beginning of the talk today, first words that came to mind were an absence of good. Mm-hmm. I was trained in the Greek philosophy, and I still like that absence of good, but I have trouble with, I took 3 years of philosophy and I never understood it. And I obviously, and then I became a storyteller, and I see so much more value for me in finding the truth through story than through philosophy, which is the way Jesus taught, through story. But I was thinking of the absence of good, and I was reading a book on the Beatitudes by a Russian Orthodox, I was thinking, you know, how we put them and us and good and evil. Evil is the absence of good. But we have to remember, I think, and I saw this in the book on the Beatitudes, that each person is an icon of God. And sometimes it's really hard to see the picture. You know, some people make it easier and some people make it more difficult. But I think that to find the icon is kind of my goal in life. That there is evil, and I can hate the evil but still find the good person that's there.
Well, I'm going to do a terrible thing. I'm going to deconstruct this. Because it does sound good, like Augustine's idea, you know, that evil is the absence of good. But if as soon as you make an assertion about good and evil, you've already done a dichotomy. Mm-hmm. Your language is decide you've done good and evil. So I'm just hoping that you'll stay in that open place. Because what I'm going to try and do tomorrow is look at evil actions and see actually how God is working in evil actions. And that's going to be pretty hard to do.
Yeah.
But I'm going to do it actually in the story of psychoanalysis, in the actual clinical situation. And hopefully you'll all be able to resonate to this, because we're all human beings. And psychoanalysis doesn't expose anything that something special about a psychoanalytic patient. It's about the dark side of the personality. So I'm going to be talking about Carl Jung's idea of the shadow, which is the so-called evil part in all of us, and actually appears as evil figures, and particularly in our dreams. And luckily for most of us, it doesn't get a grip on us. Although from time to time, we do things which we do think are evil, but not the grip that we've seen in the 9/11 or that we see here. So what I'm going to be trying to do tomorrow is to sort of find a redemptive center in evil. So wait till try to get away from those words. One way that I'm defining evil today is exclusion. And that's why I'm trying to bring evil into our discussions and not have the absence of good, evil the absence of good. So I want to try and include everything. And that what the manifestation of evil is the exclusion. And then the exclusion becomes, remember, the shunning, the denigrating, the shaming. Usually the shaming first, like which we do that right away with our kids, you know. We shame them, even in the little things that we say. And then the denigrating gets worse, and then the shunning, and then the massive exclusions, like the ethnic cleansing sorts of things. And then we get the obliteration and the killing and the wars and all that. So exclusion really just is the beginning, which ends up as killing. Okay? So I'm trying to make a plea for inclusion, and this is the postmodernist plea. And then the postmodernist theology, as we'll see, shows us ways of doing this. We're going to be talking about, first of all, we'll talk about Carl Jung's theories, analytic theories. Then we'll be talking about Emmanuel Levinas, Karl Barth, and Martin Buber. So I'm giving you some clues.
Yeah, okay.
I couldn't hold attention.
So really it's away from either or thinking into both and thinking.
Well, even that both and, you see,
it's... Yes, it's a different...
Both and's a different...
Construct, yeah.
So we've got to... Any dichotomy
is exclusive in its very nature.
That's right. And what we're trying to do in contemporary psychoanalysis is actually keep that process moving. So if we have a and or if we have anything like an is word, something is something, we're closing things off. Or even an I statement, I am. An I am statement is a problematic statement. So it becomes, that gets us into the uncertainty side of things. I am a person who, blah, 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 blah. And therefore that's saying I am something. And that's getting us into a statement that somebody else is something else, you see. Get the idea? So it's all in language. Actually, when you're doing psychoanalysis, you're actually listening to the words people are using in terms of asserting things that state things that are stable. We're trying to help us be in a much more unstable state, that some of our religious rituals, when we follow them carefully, help us to enter into. Like Easter really is helping us enter into a very unstable state. That's why I think Easter is our most important time of the year for us as Christians. It's a wonderful gift, actually, we have as Christians that a lot of other religions don't have. We follow. And Easter Saturday, again, is the key part of that unstable place. So we're trying to get you into instability, lack of assertions about I.
So how about I am unstable?
That's better than I am. A couple more minutes for questions.
When we go on with this, I think that the church is guilty of this, and we are guilty of this, and just maybe it's because of language, that we don't associate ourselves with evil. And I don't know, since becoming a Christian, I see incredible evil in myself.
Right.
And so it makes it really hard for me, harder for me as I go on, to want to go over there and kill somebody and wipe out their children and their families and do all of this to them. When I myself see myself struggle with evil, I see it in my family. I mean, incredible struggle with it down through the generations, not just, I'm not talking about just my children, but I can look down through the generations. There were slave owners, serious slave owners, and you know, you can kind of see this go through, and it generationally there's evil coming through, you know, and it's not like you get out of there and you're okay.
Right.
You don't. Even if you make the escape from your family in an evil situation, so you come out seeing the horrors of slavery, you have to face the maybe the discrimination of your family. And so when you come out, I mean, it's only coming out a little bit each time. I mean, it's only seeing the light day by day. And so will we stay in there as people? Everyone is evil to its degrees.
What we want to try and do, you know, with great, being a Christian, I think, is great, because we have this thing that we're sinners. And the very first thing we do is we have the confession of sins. I think that's terrific. That's what I love about it. Sins are great words.
Yes. Yes.
But on the other hand, what we're going to be trying to do is to look at evil in a different way. Is actually, we're unable to be rid of evil. It's always there in this way of asserting ourselves. We can't ever, it's always the excluded. That's how I'm defining it. So it's not so much bad in the moral sense, it's just present. And I'm going to try to help with the aid of some of the postmodernist theologians, and really going back to Jesus in a certain sense, because I've got a wonderful quote from Jesus, which I won't tell you yet. It was in one of the lost gospels that got dug up. But evil is actually essential. What gets consolated as evil is actually an essential part of the human personality and of the religious experience. It's just how evil gets manifested when it's not incorporated and lived out in the way that it can be constructive. Evil can actually be constructive. Although, there we are, I've done dichotomies, destructive and constructive.
I find myself wondering what C.S. Lewis would make of this. Particularly, I think of the Screwtape Letters.
What was that?
The Screwtape Letters, where old Screwtape was saying, good, you've got him thinking now in postmodernism terms, and that there is no devil, there is no Satan.
Right.
So you're halfway there.
Right.
Toward conquering this poor, weak human being.
So what would C.S. what would his comment be on all this?
That's what I'm wondering. What would he say? Would he say, where is, what do we do with the idea of the devil or Satan?
Well, what we're trying to do is actually incorporate Satan and discover what Satan's M.O. was. Because remember, Satan was the light bringer, Lucifer, and he was kicked out of heaven in one of the original dichotomies. So we're actually wanting to look at evil. We're not wanting to excuse dreadful, violent acts or shunning or shame or anything like that. But hopefully by the end of the next session, we're going to be looking at evil in a different way. Because the fact that we all contain evil is just an inherent part of our minds. As Jung says, the shadow can never be fully incorporated or overcome. And the shadow is, what I'm going to try and help you see is the shadow is full of a type of energy, a type of revival energy. People that are very, very good people are often people devoid of much energy and vitality. And the evil people are often the people who are running around and doing all sorts of horrible things, but certainly full of vitality.
Very busy.
They've been very busy people. So we're actually going to be taking up the idea, of course, that we're all containing evil, but that evil is actually a vital part of the personality. Not only that, but actually it's part of the nature of God. This was one of Carl Jung's theories that got him into terrible trouble with the church at the end of his life. He actually made it real. He made it real that somehow evil was a real thing. We're going to be trying to see how evil is, it's like you say, it's there. And in the process of transformation, it can be.
Wow.
So now you're getting to having nightmares.
I noticed you used
therapy. We need therapy. There's lots of therapy.
Not to harp on Satan or the devil, but I noticed you put the devil in the past tense, what the devil was about, or so on. Is that intentional?
Well, the devil is a concept, although he's still around, you know, we hear about it.
You just said was, and I wanted to clarify what you said, that was about the devil instead of is.
Well, we're trying to get the thing, the the whatever the devil signifies, to bring the devil back into us as humans, whatever that devilish thing that was signified over the ages and was kicked out of heaven early on, Christ's brother, we're trying to now bring that back and to see what that actually means about human life. What is that devilishness in us that's there? What does that speak to psychologically about us? And spiritually, you'll see, as we go along. It's a very, very potent spiritual element as well. So that's it for today.
Stay tuned.
Thank you.
No, all right, we're here.